All right, well, it's 6:08 according to the big clock on the wall here in Binghamton, New York, and you know what that's time for?
Time for Vegan Rainbow.
This is Bill Houston.
And Mike Hudak.
So who's our guest today, Mike?
Yeah, our guest is author and activist Keith Akers. Keith's interest in religion began at an early age. In 1967, as a teenager, he delivered a youth sermon at the First Baptist Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And in this sermon, he stated that the church was irrelevant to many urgent concerns of the day. Keith went on to major in philosophy in college, but then found employment in the computer industry. Keith became alerted to the problem of human violence during the Vietnam War, and in the early 1970s became aware of the environmental crisis fueled by rampant consumerism in American society and also by human overpopulation. Keith became a vegetarian in 1978 and a vegan, that is, abstaining from all animal-derived foods, in 1981. He wrote his first book, a vegetarian source book, in 1983. In 2000, Keith wrote his second book, The Lost Religion of Jesus, Simple Living and Nonviolence in Early Christianity. Keith has been very active as a vegetarian activist, serving at various times as president of the Vegetarian Society of the District of Columbia, president of the Vegetarian Society of Colorado, and as an officer in the International Vegetarian Union. Keith Akers joins us today from Denver, Colorado, for a conversation about vegetarianism and Christianity. Keith, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Glad to be here.
Welcome. I'd like to talk a little bit about that youth sermon that you delivered. That must have really shocked many members of your church's congregation. Can you tell us what you meant when you said that the contemporary Christian church was irrelevant to many urgent concerns of the day?
The point that I was making in that sermon was based on Matthew 25, which is the Last Judgment parable in which Jesus divides the sheep from the goats, or the Son of Man divides the sheep from the goats, and he says to the people, on one hand, you can enter the kingdom of heaven because when I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. And when I was in prison, you visited me, and so forth. And then they reply, well, when did we see you hungry, thirsty, or in prison, etc.? And he says, as you have done it to the least of these, you have done it unto me. So this, to me, embodies the Christian message. It's something that's supposed to change our lives. Whereas I saw the church as being preoccupied with theology, whether you're saved or not, whether the Bible is the Word of God, things like that, which I think are interesting to discuss, but I don't think that they are the most important things for Christianity. I don't think that Jesus came to establish a theological system or anything even remotely close to that. I believe that he was just a good Jew who was trying to make Judaism relevant to the people and concerns of his day. Mm-hmm. So that's where I was coming from in my sermon. At that time, I didn't have some of the ideas that I do now, but nevertheless, that the church should be relevant to what we're doing and should affect a change in people's lives. That's something that I still believe in.
Keith, you became a vegetarian in 1978 and a vegan in 1981, yet you had become concerned about violence and the environmental impacts of civilization nearly a decade earlier. Can you tell us the process that you went through during those years of the 1970s that finally brought you to adopting a vegetarian diet?
Well, it was a long process, and I think that it's in common with a lot of the people of my generation in that day, and also it reflects the changes that people go through today when they are confronted with something that forces them to change their own lives in a substantial way. Just confusion, that it's hard to reject something that for many people their families practice and 95%, 98% of the population also practices, like meat eating or acceptance of war, or acceptance of any number of other things that are very common in society. The whole sort of consumer framework that we've gotten into, which teaches us that the more things that we have, the more successful we are, the whole framework. And so I was coming up to it from the point of view of vegetarianism, because here was something which I felt was pretty obvious. That is, we didn't need to kill animals for food. And yet, here we are killing animals for food, and not just killing them, but killing them by the billions. By not just the millions or the hundreds of millions, but by billions every year.
So then it was not long after that that you began writing a vegetarian source book. That is, you said you became a vegan in 1981. I assume it was around that time that you began writing this book. It was published in 1983.
Yes. As soon as I sort of converted to vegetarianism, like many other activists, I said, well, wow, this is great. How can I go out and get everybody else to see this idea? And I realized that there were a lot of people who weren't interested in it. And at that time, I felt the major problem, in fact, I think to a certain extent still the major problem, is just lack of information about vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. People were vegetarians for all kinds of ideas and for all kinds of reasons, some of them good and some of them not so good. And I wanted to straighten all that out and to give a coherent account of the major issues surrounding vegetarianism. And I saw those issues as being nutrition, ecology, and ethics. Just as I started writing the book, or as I got the idea of writing the book, because I hadn't totally convinced myself that I could even do this, that just at the time when I started writing the book, I became a vegan, because I realized that all the arguments for vegetarianism also applied to veganism as well. That is, if you didn't believe in eating meat because of cholesterol, well, dairy products and eggs, even though a vegetarian could eat dairy products and eggs, dairy products and eggs also have cholesterol. And you can go down all the other arguments for vegetarianism as well, and they also have an impact on veganism. Veganism, I have to say, though, is more difficult than vegetarianism for social reasons. And so I am completely in sympathy with vegetarians who can't make the transition to veganism, or that are almost vegan or something like that, because it is really just a lot of social problems that come up. The main one, for example, is just baked goods. If you're a vegetarian, you can pretty much eat any bread or baked good, cupcakes, cakes, anything like that, that will be brought out at work. But if you're a vegan, you probably can't eat very much of it at all, because usually these baked goods have small amounts of dairy products or eggs and so forth. Mm-hmm. So people react to this in different ways. So I'm very sympathetic to people who are almost vegetarian or almost vegan. To me, this is not that big of a deal, so I'm not condemning people that eat dairy products once a week or even every day if they don't eat very much of it and so forth and so on. So the real challenge of being a vegetarian or a vegan is not really figuring out what to eat, but really the social problems that it involves.
There's a lot of hidden animal ingredients that in various things that make it very difficult, I think, to become a vegan. I think that there are some people that probably try the best they can to be a vegan, but still go and buy buy envelopes that have glues made from animal hides or hooves. You know, we just don't know in the products that we buy whether they contain animal ingredients or not, because there's no requirements for them to label things as such.
Exactly. That's the kind of thing. Once you get started, you can eliminate meat from your diet, and you can even eliminate all animal products from your diet. But once you get started, it's like, where do you stop? Because you can pursue this question forever, like investigating, as you mentioned, whether postage stamps have animal products in them and so forth and so on. And you can get really wrapped up into this. And so I would just say to most people, like, do the best you can and don't worry about it a lot. If you're not eating meat or fish, you've eliminated probably about two-thirds of the animal suffering. And if you're not eating dairy products or eggs, you've eliminated most of the rest. Even with something blatant like the wearing of furs, not that many people wear fur, and so it's not that large of a percentage of the suffering.
Keith, can you talk a little bit about the two other aspects that you covered in your book, that is ecology and ethics, and how that relates to a vegetarian or vegan diet?
Certainly. I think actually that ecology may be the most important reason for being a vegetarian in terms of convincing people to be vegetarian, because I think we face an environmental crisis. And people can sort of slough off health. They can say, for example, well, I don't care if I live to be 85 or 75 or whatever. What difference does that make? You can sort of slough off health, and you can even slough off ethics. Why should we care about these animals? But ecology really affects the whole planet. It affects not only the individual, but it affects society and the future of many other species on Earth. I'm convinced that we're facing a serious environmental crisis and that we need to reverse course in a number of directions, one of the most important of which is food, but also affecting energy, global warming, deforestation, and so forth. And all of these reasons or concerns about the environment are related to vegetarianism in some way. Even something like global warming is related to the environment because we are deforesting large areas of the earth to graze cattle. And what does deforestation do? It puts more carbon into the atmosphere and contributes to global warming and so forth. So all of these are really related, but we've really got to deal with the food crisis. Global grain production per capita has been declining, I think, since the 1980s, and so it's been going on for some time. Clearly, this is a trend which cannot continue, and a lot of it's due to just the increase in population. But just in the last couple of years, it's been an absolute decline in grain production. So I think that we've really peaked in the amount of food that we could produce on the earth, and it's going to be declining. It's declining because of soil erosion, because of groundwater depletion, because of all of these reasons which are really putting a restriction on how much food we can get out of the earth, and we've got to come to terms with this. Mm-hmm. Meat production is just really, really wasteful in terms of the resources that it uses. You can produce 5, 10, 20 times as much plant food as you can animal food from a given amount of agricultural resources, whether you figure that in terms of land, water, energy. It's basically eating low on the food chain. If you eat high on the food chain, you're going to take a whole lot more resources. And that's what most Americans are doing. And that's what most of the world wants to be like, too. Most of the world wants to be like us. And so meat production is going up at the same time that grain production is going down. And obviously it can't continue, and we're going to have a crisis, I think, pretty soon. Lester Brown says we're going to have a crisis within the next year or two, that there's going to be a major impact. What Lester Brown has said is that we've all been waiting. A lot of people have said, well, there's dire predictions about what's going to happen to the environment, and at some point there's going to be some sort of major shock that we're going to get. But nobody can really predict when or where it's going to come. We know that the situation is deteriorating, but we don't know precisely when it's going to become obvious. And he says that it's going to be obvious in the next couple of years, and it's going to take the form of a food crisis.
Your book does have a strong emphasis on the environmental consequences of a meat-based diet, as you've just been indicating. Yet many vegetarian organizations are primarily focused on human health or animal rights. And I have some experience with this. Back in 2001, I was invited to speak at the National Conference of the North American Vegetarian Society. And I was speaking on the environmental impacts of livestock production, particularly ranching in the western United States. And about 5 people showed up for my talk. Now, there were 3 or 4 other sessions taking place at the same time, but there were 600 people at this conference, and I think only 5 people coming to hear my talk gives some indication that there really wasn't a lot of interest about this topic. I don't know whether the experiences here at this national conference were representative of vegetarians throughout the United States, perhaps not, but I just wondered, do you have any comments on that issue?
Yes, I think that to a great extent it's because the vegetarian movement has become overly sectarian in its outlook. I think that people have lost touch with the rest of the universe. And this is sort of good news and sort of bad news. It's good news. I think it's a good thing for vegetarians to get with each other and build up relationships with each other and so forth and so on. I think we want to strengthen the vegetarian community, but I don't think that we want to completely separate ourselves from the rest of society. Mm-hmm. I think that this is what's happened. And I think that the environment is something that's clearly of major concern to a lot of other social organizations, the Sierra Club, various other environmental groups, major groups with lots and lots of members who are obviously concerned about the environment. Mm-hmm. And yet, where do we see either vegetarianism discussed with them at all, just in a friendly way, not necessarily saying you have to be vegetarian, but just to raise the subject at all? how are vegetarians supposed to interact with these people? So I think they've gotten off. I think it's been, to a certain extent, both health and the animal rights movement have sort of missed the point. They've gotten sort of on their own little framework and sort of lost track with what other people who are also socially conscious are doing. So that's my concern. The vegetarian movement is becoming a bit too sectarian. Of course, you could say that some of it is, well, we need a strong speaker like a John Robbins or a Howard Lyman to speak out about the environment. And from time to time they do, but still, the fact is that there's not that much interest in the environment at conferences or among what I would say the movement. Now, among ordinary vegetarians, I think it's somewhat different. I think that among ordinary vegetarians, a lot of them do have a concern about the environment, but somehow the movement seems to be geared more towards animal rights and health.
Well, it's been about 20 years now since you wrote the Source book. Do you think that there are major developments in these issues? Have there been any significant breakthroughs in research on human health in those 20 years that would make it more or less compelling to adopt a vegetarian diet for even health reasons?
I believe that there has been not that much change in the state of the evidence about vegetarianism in the last 20 years, except that it's become a little more solid. I think that just as I was writing my book, one of the things that I actually had to go back and change one of the last drafts of was to include some of the latest research on cancer and diet, which was just then coming into view, like in the early 1980s was when the community of scientists that was working on cancer realized, hey, we've got a real problem. There really is a connection between diet and cancer here, and it's mostly the Western diet, which emphasizes meat production and meat consumption and so forth, is causing cancer. The evidence is somewhat solidified, but basically the case for vegetarianism in 1983 and then in 2004 is about the same. There are two major developments that have happened, which was not the case in 1983, was the development of mad cow disease and the development of genetic engineering. Both of these were things that weren't really visible at all. In fact, mad cow disease was totally invisible at that time. So those are the two major developments. But I think that the evidence is just as solid now as it was then. In fact, I think it's somewhat more solidified. And what we've observed is not so much that the evidence has really changed, but that people's attitudes towards the evidence has changed. The one major health development, I would say, would be Dean Ornish, when he showed that heart disease not only could be prevented on a low-fat vegetarian diet with meditation and exercise, but he showed that it could actually be reversed. So I would mention that. But other than that, there hasn't been that much change in the issues.
Moving on to your second book, The Lost Religion of Jesus. As in the Source book, you dealt with issues of ethics and religion, only more so here. And in this second book, you link vegetarianism and Christianity. Yet the contemporary vegetarian movement is, as you pointed out, and the animal rights movement even, for the most part, appear secular. Why do you think there isn't much support for these issues within mainstream Christianity?
And within mainstream vegetarianism as well, because mainstream vegetarianism doesn't really see itself as a spiritual movement. Now, I don't think that vegetarianism has to be like totally a religious thing or a spiritual thing or anything like that, but I think that there needs to be more of a consciousness of spiritual issues in the vegetarian movement, and I think there needs to be more of a consciousness of vegetarianism in Christianity. The one reason that vegetarians have rejected religion, and I think that unfortunately vegetarianism as a movement tends to be anti-Christian in its orientation. That's unfortunate, but it's a fact. Not totally. There are Christian vegetarians and so forth, but there's a tendency in the movement for the vegetarians to be anti-Christian. And part of this is just because of the attitudes of Christianity. Christianity, for centuries, has taught that humans have dominion over animals, and that it's okay to eat animals. And, in fact, any suggestion that it's wrong to eat animals must be rejected. And one of the main trumps that they have used is the fact that Jesus was not a vegetarian, or they say that Jesus was not a vegetarian. And so a lot of Christians, if they're ever confronted with this issue, they just say, well, Jesus wasn't a vegetarian, Paul wasn't a vegetarian, they all ate meat, why can't I eat meat? What's wrong? with eating meat. And so Christian theology has generally rejected vegetarianism, with a few exceptions, like the Seventh-day Adventists. And so vegetarians, in turn, have rejected Christianity. And so we have this gap between Christianity and vegetarianism, which has developed. And the two sides essentially aren't really talking to each other right now, I would say.
In your book, you actually go so far as to argue that Jesus has disappeared from Christianity. What do you mean by that?
Yes, I think that the religion of Jesus has been lost from modern Christianity. The message of Jesus was about simple living and nonviolence. Simple living and nonviolence. Read the Gospels, look at the history of the early church. This is what early Christians saw as the essence of their message. This is what the first Jewish Christians, the early followers of Jesus who were Jews, saw themselves as practicing. They had everything in common. They shared between themselves and with the community. They were pacifists. They objected to violence in any form, war in any form, even when it was fought in the name of the Roman Empire. In fact, perhaps especially when it was fought in the name of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And today, Christianity has largely lost this orientation towards simple living and nonviolence. It's okay to consume lots of stuff, to eat meat and drink wine and do whatever else you want, just to consume, drive cars or whatever. And also, it's okay to wage war to defend your consumptive way of life also. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is something that Jesus would reject, and I'm surprised that Christianity has not risen up with a single voice and said materialism and violence is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Keith, are you familiar with the writings and the works of Father John Deere?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, he seems to be one of the few people that seems to be making the same connections that you are, that about the message of Jesus being living simply and nonviolence. He has a paper that's on the internet called Christianity and Vegetarianism, Pursuing the Nonviolence of Jesus.
Yes, there are a number of people who have pointed out problems with violence, materialism, meat eating, whatever it is. Christianity should be condemning these things, not endorsing them. But unfortunately, they are in the minority. And I hope that people will pay more attention to people such as John Deere and other people. Regina Highland, I think, is another notable person who's written very extensively on Christianity and vegetarianism. And I hope that people would pay more attention to these writers.
Can you just say a few words about how Christianity got to this point? Are there some key events, key factors that caused Christianity to become what it is today and to have abandoned those early principles?
I think that there are two key factors which are involved, and all of them are well in ancient Christianity. The first, or the life and writings of Paul, I think that Paul had a lot of things right about what he said. I don't think that Paul is totally a villain by any means, but he did not see vegetarianism as being necessary or desirable at all. And so he got into a dispute over vegetarianism. And you can read about this in the New Testament. You can look at Romans 14. You can look at 1 Corinthians 8 through 10. You can see Paul's comments about the vegetarianism, which was very evident in early Christianity. Many early Christians, we're talking the apostolic age now, thought that vegetarianism was not only a good idea, but it was actually should be required of all Christians. And Paul rejected that. Now, even after the writings of Paul, the church did not universally come around to accept his point of view. And there were many people, prominent people within the church, who were vegetarians. But the second problem arose when King Constantine, the first so-called Christian emperor, who presided over the Council of Nicaea in the year 325, Constantine really extinguished what was original Christianity. He really made it all right to wage war, to commit acts of violence, made it all right to consume whatever you wanted, basically gave a justification to the upper classes to continue their dominion and so forth. So Constantine really, I think, had more of an effect even than Paul on changing Christianity, shall we say, from the religion of Jesus to something which I think is really fundamentally different from the religion of Jesus. It really does not pay any attention to the issues that Jesus wanted to pay attention to, namely simple living and nonviolence. And they did draw attention to other issues which I think Jesus would have thought nothing about. They tried to create an elaborate theological system, and I don't think that Jesus wanted to create a theology at all, and if he wanted to create a theological system, certainly would not have created the system that came out of the Council of Nicaea. If you look at the Nicene Creed, you see nothing, not one mention of simple living and nonviolence, or any other ethical concern of Jesus. What you instead have is theological statement after theological statement after theological statement. Christianity is not about theology. Christianity is about transforming your life. Most of Christianity, unfortunately, has missed the religion of Jesus.
What evidence do you have that Jesus and the first Christians were actually interested in vegetarianism? Is there evidence in the New Testament, or are you citing other sources?
There's evidence both inside and outside of the New Testament. We know that the first Christians, or shall we say, because this is actually before the term Christian even began to be used, the first followers of Jesus were Jews. Jesus was a Jew, all of his first apostles and disciples were Jews, and yet, within 100 years, the majority of Christians, majority of so-called followers of Jesus, were not Jews. And in fact, Judaism was totally rejected by most of Christianity. If you look at the Jewish Christians were vegetarians. They were pacifists. They believed in simple living. They kept the essential ethical message of Jesus. And when you look in the letters of Paul, you can see clearly that Paul is in a major discussion with other Christians about vegetarianism. So it's clear that vegetarianism was a hot topic in early Christianity. And one of the main issues that the Jewish Christians had was the issue of animal sacrifice. And animal sacrifice is mentioned extensively in the New Testament, or very important, I should say, in the New Testament, because this is probably the issue that got Jesus killed. Jesus, in the last week of his life, went in and disrupted the animal sacrifice business in the temple. He drove out the people who were selling and buying. What were they selling and buying? They were selling and buying animal sacrifice. The temple in Jerusalem was nothing like a modern synagogue or a modern church or anything like that. It resembled more closely a slaughterhouse or a butcher shop in which animals were sacrificed and then presented to the priest. It was essentially a killing ground of some sort. So this is what Jesus was disrupting. This is what Jesus was disrupting. And it's probably what got Jesus killed, because why would Pilate have crucified Jesus, wanted to destroy Jesus? Now, I think there's a lot of discussion about Mel Gibson's movie about Jesus. I think that a lot of the objections to this movie center around the presentation of Pilate, which unfortunately is precisely the presentation that's found in the Gospels, that Pilate is very reluctant and the Jews have to talk him into crucifying Jesus. Well, in fact, Pilate, as a good Roman governor, would have wanted to maintain order in Jerusalem during the Passover season, which is a very volatile time. Riots could break out at the Passover if something went wrong, and so he had to be very concerned. And so here's someone, Jesus, who's disrupting the business in the temple. What is the business of the temple? The business of the temple was to sacrifice animals and to present them to the priest. And that's what Jesus is disrupting. That's probably what got Jesus killed, because what he does is create a threat to public order. He disrupts public order. That's why he got crucified.
So you're claiming then that the real problem there was over animal sacrifice and not over what is more claimed today in mainstream Christianity, that Jesus was simply opposed to the conjunction of commerce and religion.
I think that Jesus certainly would have been opposed to commerce and religion, but this is not the main problem. Read the Gospels. The money changers are nowhere at the top of the list of the people that Jesus is objecting to when he goes into the temple. Everybody remembers this incident as, oh, Jesus goes in and overturns the tables of the money changers. But who does he go after first? He goes after the people who are selling and buying animals. And in fact, in Luke, the money changers aren't even mentioned. This incident is put in all four Gospels, and in Luke, they're not even mentioned. So I don't think the real issue was commerce. I think the issue was what you were doing with commerce. Obviously, if animal sacrifice had been all right, you would have had to have had animals there. You would have had to have people buying and selling animals in order for the basic operations of the temple to take place. But Jesus didn't think that animal sacrifice was appropriate. That's why he was baptized rather than making an animal sacrifice, because the function of baptism in early Christianity was the same as the function of animal sacrifice, or one of the functions of animal sacrifice in the Judaism of his day. It only did not require that anything be killed.
How do you deal with the issue of Jesus eating meat?
Well, I don't think that Jesus ate meat. I think Jesus was a vegetarian. And the reason I think that Jesus was a vegetarian is because this is what the Jewish Christians believed. This is what the Jewish Christians thought. They thought that Jesus taught and practiced vegetarianism, and many early Christians in the church were vegetarian. And when Paul tries to deal with these early Christian vegetarians in Romans, he doesn't say, well, Jesus wasn't a vegetarian. He says, well, we can't make this a requirement on everyone. That's what his argument is. Whereas if Jesus had not been a vegetarian, there were people alive in Paul's day who still knew Jesus, and it would have been very easy for Paul to say, well, Jesus wasn't a vegetarian, what's the point? So I think that Jesus was a vegetarian. I think that there are isolated passages in the scripture which have been used, blown out of proportion, which, first of all, probably are not true, and secondly, have been blown out of proportion about the loaves and the fishes and so forth. The incident of the loaves and the fishes, I think it was originally just bread. And if you look at extra-biblical accounts of the miracle of the loaves and the fishes, you see that several people, early church writers, such as Irenaeus, Epiphanius, Arnobius, Eusebius, and others, refer to this incident as being simply the miracle of the bread. And the fish was, I believe, added later.
Let's talk a little bit about Judaism then. Of course, Jesus was a Jew, and the early followers of Jesus were Jews. There is something of a movement even within Judaism known as Jews for Jesus. Do you see any parallels between them and the early Jewish Christians?
No. Unfortunately, they're totally different groups altogether. The Jews for Jesus are essentially Jews who have converted to modern-day Christianity. They accept the literal interpretation of the Bible, they accept the Trinity, and they accept the legitimacy of meat-eating and so forth. But whereas, in fact, the early Jewish Christians rejected certain texts of the Bible, the text specifically that ordained animal sacrifice, the early Jewish Christians said, the prophets didn't write this, Moses didn't write this, scribes went in and altered the scriptures to make it reflect what they wanted. And they also rejected the virgin birth. They rejected the Trinity as well. So early Jewish Christians are totally at odds with the modern Jews for Jesus.
Let's talk a little bit more about nonviolence. The subtitle of your book mentions this. And can you talk a little bit more about Jesus's view on nonviolence?
I think even in the Gospels, it's clear that Jesus is against war. I think that this is one of the clearest teachings in the Gospels, but it's one, unfortunately, which Christianity has great difficulty accepting. Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, and so forth and so on. All of these well-known sayings of Jesus point towards a basic pacifism of the early Christians. And in fact, the majority of early Christians in the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd centuries, even Gentile or Jewish Christians, they were all largely pacifist in nature. It was just accepted as a matter of course. And just a decade or two before Constantine came to power, we saw that there were Christian martyrs who refused to serve in the Roman army. And they objected not to the particular cause or the particular social context of what the Roman army was doing, but just because it was killing. The killing in itself was wrong. What they saw was that there needed to be a movement which transcended borders and national identities, which would essentially sweep these institutions away, or at least the ability to wage war away from these institutions, and create a new force which would be based on nonviolence. And that everyone, they saw Christianity growing and spreading in spite of the fact that it never used weapons of violence. So I think that if we could recover that spirit in early Christianity, we might be able to put an end to war. But most Christians have essentially bought into the whole idea of war, and therefore we have to wage wars, and as long as that we're right and they're wrong, it's okay to kill as many people as we need to.
And we have a phone call. Would you like to take a phone call?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Hello, caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Do you have a question for Keith Akers?
Yes. I was raised as a Catholic and turned away from the church because of their view about animals, among other things. And even though I was given religious instruction, I never learned about the correlation between Meatless Fridays and giving up meat for Lent. And I was just wondering if that has something to do with what you were talking about earlier about Christians, the early Christians.
Yes, the Meatless Fridays. Now, I was not raised as a Catholic, but I always knew that when we went to the school lunch line that there would be fish there because we knew the Catholics would want not to eat red meat. Well, it's unfortunate that they didn't exclude all meat, that they let people eat fish. But still, this is the last sort of remnant of vegetarianism in early Christianity, which has sort of been reflected in Catholicism. And it's a reflection that vegetarianism was an ideal in the church. And so it got pushed back and pushed back and pushed back so that now it's only one day a week and it's not even all meat. It's just all animals except fish. So, yes, I think this is an excellent point.
Okay, thank you.
So, Keith, is it your view then that the early Christians viewed all war as unjustifiable, even defense?
Yes, I think that they specifically rejected wars of defense. Now, it's true that when they thought of wars of defense, they thought of the Roman Empire defending itself, but they didn't identify that much with the Roman Empire also. But they saw any government that relies on violence to maintain itself, they saw that as an immoral government. Mm-hmm. And so the question of whether we should fight wars in defense didn't really come up for them. They saw even barbarians that were attacking Rome, they didn't see a need to defend against them. In fact, what they did was they went out to the barbarians and tried to convert them to be Christians as well.
But I was thinking in terms of, let's say, some organized group defending itself against the Roman Empire.
Yes, and perhaps so. But I think this is a danger which modern Christians could get into. That is, thinking that while it's all right for Americans to be pacifists, but these other groups do not have to be pacifists. I think that violence is bad no matter which government perpetrates. Somehow, I think the message of Jesus is, at least, whether we can accept it or not, is that we should not be loyal to any institution that requires violence. We've had violence going on since the years when Jesus was alive and even before. The systems of violence continue. You can see that in the situation in Iraq, where I don't think that any side is really justified in using violence. I don't think the Americans or the insurgents or anybody. This is a prime example of how pointless violence is. People think that it resolves something, and it may resolve something for a couple of generations, and then you've got it back again. You've got to resolve the whole problem over again. We thought the Second World War resolved something. Apparently, it may have resolved something, but what precisely it resolved, we're still struggling with questions of national identity and race and so forth, and we're trying to resolve these by violence, and I'm not sure that that's going to work.
Keith, we have a question from Jeff, our phone screener.
It sounds like what you're saying is the Bible as it is today in various forms is inaccurate or has been somewhat distorted.
Yeah, I don't accept the literal interpretation of the Bible, if that's what you mean. As a case in point, I would just say, and just putting aside the whole issue of evolution or creation, all that stuff, forget about that. If that was the only problem, I think we could resolve it. But what do you do about instances in which God goes out and commands the children of Israel to make war on the Amalekites, and not only to defeat them, but to kill all the women and children and the animals? And when Saul spares the king and some of the animals, then God says to him through a prophet, you really aren't doing the job here. You've got to go out and kill them all. Do you think that that really happened? Do you think that that's the word of God? Do you think that God wanted us ever to go out and do these kinds of things? And what about animal sacrifices? Do you think that God commands us to go out and kill animals in his name? I don't think so. I think that it's really the ethical problems with the Bible. Now, of course, the Bible has other things in it also. It also has prophets which condemn animal sacrifices. Isaiah goes on at great length to say, your countless sacrifices what are they to me? Wash your hands of blood and be clean. And there are other passages in the prophets which object to animal sacrifice. And also, they shall beat their swords into plowshares. And all of these passages in different parts of the Old Testament are also found. So you can find different things in the Bible. And I think that Norm Phelps' analysis was pretty good. He says that there's a basic message of God, but then things come in that sort of distort it. So I think that we have to understand what the basic message is and then what's extraneous stuff that got in there somehow, because the people that wrote the Bible, the scribes, the copiers, the translators, and so forth, are human. I think that error can creep in.
So that often becomes sort of a threat to the religious community when the accuracy of the Bible is threatened somewhat, I think.
Yes.
I was just wondering, what is the response of the religious community? Are they accepting the idea of vegetarian, simple living, nonviolence, or are they having more trouble with getting beyond the Bible as a literal translation from God or something?
I think that this is sort of a classic religious clash. If you go back and look at the history of religion, not just Christianity, but Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, you name it, you can see this all the time. People are arguing about the tradition, and there's always a case where somebody comes forward and says, well, you know, this is not the way we were taught it. And then the prophet will say, well, it's the way it should be, and so forth, and so on. I think that we're trapped in this sort of cycle right now. The religious communities need to be waking up, to put it in Christian terms, the Holy Spirit, to wake up to the Holy Spirit and ask themselves, okay, forget about tradition. Is this what God wants? Is this what you think God wants? And to be open to what someone, some force more powerful than ourselves might say about that. So that's where I see that. And also on the other side, in the secular community, in the vegetarian community and the movements for social change, which unfortunately also tend to be very secular and sort of ignore the spiritual aspects, that they need to be aware that there's more to religion than just established religion and a bunch of traditions.
Yeah. Keith, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you.
Keith, do you have a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Yes, it's www.compassionatespirit.com.
Thanks very much for being on the show.
It's a pleasure. Goodbye.
So long.